Why do we crave social connection? Why do certain people we're close to cause us stress? Why does politics seem to put our relationships under more strain than it seems like anything else? For the rest of the programme, I'm bringing you my conversation with the writer David Robson as we discuss the answers to these questions and more ahead of the release of his new book, The Laws of Connection.
One thing I was really fascinated by in the book is the fact that, as you might expect, our strongest social connections are the most beneficial for our well-being. But it's not necessarily our most antagonistic relationships or the people we're least keen on that are most detrimental to our well-being, is it? It's the ones in between.
Right. So obviously we try to keep the kind of really mean and nasty people to a minimum, but sometimes you can't avoid them. It could just be a colleague you really don't get on with. But those people are certainly not good for our health, but they're not as bad as the people who blow hot and cold. Those Jekyll and Hyde characters who might one day act like they're your best friend and then the next day they might lash out because they feel jealous. This inconsistency is very stressful for us. There's this uncertainty to each interaction with those people. Because they're so nice to us, we really care about what they think. And so when they're hurtful, it's even more upsetting to us. So scientists call these ambivalent relationships. I think in everyday conversation, we might refer to them as frenemies. And what the research shows is that they do have a really negative impact on our health. So just knowing that you're going to have to interact with one of these people amplifies the stress that you're already feeling. And then we know that can have knock-on consequences for things like biological aging.
When social connections are going well, what do they look like? You touch on this idea in the book of a shared reality. I wonder if you could expand on that.
This particular part of the research really blew my mind because it just crystallized so much of what I felt personally made a good relationship. The shared reality is just that sense that someone is processing the world in the same way as you are. They see events in the same way. They have the same immediate emotional reactions. They're thinking the same things. So in our kind of everyday conversations, a really good sign of this is if you start finishing each other's sentences, or if you say the same thing at the same time. You both laugh at the same joke that maybe the rest of the group don't find funny. These moments happen quite frequently amongst friends, and the more they happen, the more frequent they are, the closer they feel to each other.
Do we have any understanding of underlying mechanisms going on inside the brain when, as you describe, we have these almost two minds becoming one?
We do. And that's what I love about this research so much, is that the metaphors we use are actually very accurate, neurologically speaking. So, you know, we talk about being on the same wavelength as someone, or like you said, like we feel we've got a kind of merged mind, a single stream of consciousness. And the research suggests that actually that is what's going on in the brain. You could take a group of graduate students and show them a string of different YouTube clips. So like a music video, a comedy clip, a documentary, something quite harrowing. You know, all of these things, you could measure people's neural reactions to those events, like which areas are becoming active at which time. And just from those brain scans, the similarities in two people's brain activity turned out to predict how close they were within that group of students, like the degree of friendship within these people. So yeah, when we're friends with people, it is like our minds are actually working in sync, like we really are on the same wavelength.
While we're still on this topic, people might in the future be turning more and more to these parasocial relationships. Perhaps it might be a favourite YouTuber who they seek comfort in, or with the rise of artificial intelligence, a chatbot that can kind of mimic the effects of social connection. But I'm guessing with what you're saying, there's only so far that these relationships can really fulfill our need for social connection.
Yeah, I feel so. Parasocial relationships or technological alternatives can create the illusion of a friendship, and they can create that illusion of having a shared reality. But I think we're always going to be conscious of the distance between us and that celebrity or us and that technology. We're going to know that there fundamentally isn't this synchronous brain activity, and that they don't really understand us or get us in the way that we would crave from a real person sitting in the same room who is reacting totally spontaneously to the events around us in a way that we feel really seen and understood through that conversation.
Another way in which technology is shaping our social connections more and more is via social media. Observing other people's lives and reflecting on our own in comparison.
Absolutely. So there's just so much research showing that social comparison in all forms, you know, even before social media came along, is pretty bad for our mental well-being. It can instantly destroy any happiness you would have from any particular achievement in your life if you immediately compare yourself to someone who has achieved even more. What I think social media does is it just makes that social comparison much easier. We're probably engaging in it much more than we had in the past. As long as we are on that treadmill, like trying to compete with other people, I think we are going to feel isolated ultimately. So there's this phenomenon with a beautiful name called the beautiful mess effect. And that essentially shows we tend to be very scared about revealing any kind of vulnerability because we think it will be perceived as being weak or embarrassing. We hold these things that we feel ashamed of as secrets, and that can leave us feeling more isolated because it stops us from having that shared reality, from knowing that other people have experienced the same things as us. But what the research shows is that when people do reveal their vulnerabilities, others' perceptions are often much more positive than they believe. So rather than seeing weakness, people might see courage. And actually just the whole act of self-disclosure is giving material to build that shared reality. So if we were just a bit more honest on our social media, we might find that we receive a lot more empathy from other people than we would expect and a lot more support.
When it comes to our social connections, it feels like very few things put them under as much strain as politics. What can you tell me about the cognitive biases maybe that lead to them being such flashpoints in our relationships?
Right, and I think this comes partly because we see our political beliefs as being this core part of our identity, and it is part of our worldview. So when we find that someone who we might agree with on lots of other issues and, you know, really have that shared reality with, when we find that they don't share our political views, that can put that shared reality under stress. But actually, there are some biases that maybe lead us to be too pessimistic about the possibility of reaching mutual understanding. And so one of these is just that we have faulty assumptions about what the other person wants to achieve with these conversations. We assume that they want to just persuade us, to hit us over the heads with like facts. And sometimes we think they just want to have an argument. What we don't understand is that actually, when you look at the research, most people genuinely do want to build an understanding. They're genuinely curious about what you think. We think their motives are maybe worse than they actually are. And what I love about the research is that then they've engineered these conversations between people who disagree, and they've encouraged them to just make their interest and curiosity explicit. So people actually, rather than just jumping to those assumptions, they actually say, like, I really care about what you believe and I want to hear more about it. And they found that that immediately diffuses the landmine of the conversation. It just makes it a lot more constructive. And actually, when both parties are describing their curiosity in that way, each party is then more willing to kind of accept their own holes in their own arguments and to just be a bit more humble about their beliefs. So you can actually have a real conversation where you can both exchange your views honestly, which allows you to repair that shared reality and to come to some kind of mutual understanding. Like, even if you don't agree, you can at least identify the points on which you do agree, and you can understand why you disagree on the others and recognize that it doesn't make the other person this terrible, evil human being for thinking the way they do.
David, just to say a big thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
And if you'd like to learn more, you can read David's book, The Laws of Connection.